Let's call a meeting in order and get started this evening. We had a little confusion on what time the meeting ought to start, 6:00 or 6:30, so we waited till 6:30 to get things going. I'm Wayne McAllister, chairman and member at large. Just do quick introductions. I'll start with you, Rod.
I'm Rod Morrison, represent the Sportsman.
I'm Cy, I'm glad to be here.
We're still trying to figure out what he does here.
John Mathis, I represent the elected officials.
Mitch Hacking, I represent agriculture.
I'm Boyd Blackwell, and I'm the secretary of this wild bunch.
Joe Maddy, I'm here on behalf of agriculture.
Thanks, Alan.
I'm Dan Abeda for the Forest Service.
Randy Dearth, represent Sportsman.
David Gordon, representing the BLM.
I'm Carrie Messerly, and I'm late.
No, you're right.
I'm the vice chair and represent the public at large.
Okay.
And that's all you need is a red ball.
That's what I need.
That ball will get you going. Anybody's got comment cards on any of the agenda items, you know, fill them out, bring them up to us, so we've got them here, if you will. So I guess we need to approve the agenda. We have an agenda before us. Nobody's reviewed it. Agenda approvable.
Dare say so.
Motion or anything on the agenda?
Move to approve the agenda as presented.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Okay, Mitch seconded. Carrie moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thanks. Did you get a chance to review the minutes? We need to approve the minutes in the same manner. So, minutes of our September board meeting, you go online and listen to them or whatever, or want to approve the minutes as they have been prepared?
Move we accept the minutes.
Okay. Got a motion?
I'll second it.
Second by Dan. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Unanimous? Good. We thought we'd have a short report from Carrie on attending the state wildlife board meeting. You want to just give us a update on that?
Not a problem. It was a relatively brief wildlife board meeting, for all things considered. The biggest topic of conversation was Rule R657-13 in the fishing guidebook. It was presented. There were some amendments that were passed through the southern region that affected them. The motion was to include in the next fishery survey a question regarding the taking of catch and kill species by spear fishermen in all waters where it applies. That was probably the biggest topic of conversation. Everything was passed unanimously in accordance with the southern, southeastern region, northeastern region, and central region as presented by the state. So there were a few amendments, but for the most part, they all went as presented. So surveys were included. Other than that, it was as presented here.
Good. Good. To our agenda item 4, we need a regional update.
Yeah, it's been quite a while since we've been able to get together, and my regional staff have been extremely busy on all ends, especially our law enforcement folks. It's been kind of a wild and different year. We've been down 2 officers, but the guys have done a really, really good job of filling in and moving around, and have had several cases this year. And probably in some cases of shooting an animal, thinking it was an elk, and it turned out to be a moose, and those kinds of things. And so, but the guys have been extremely busy. Our new guy, Jake Greenwood, has basically been baptized by fire, thrown in the line, and with a new guy, he's not allowed to go out there unless he has somebody with him for the first year, almost for the first full year. He's got to get so many hours in. So that takes another guy. And so they've been really, really busy, and they've done a very good job of trying to cover the region and cover and protect our wildlife. Our habitat section, they finished a chaining, 980-acre chaining up on Moon Ridge for deer, elk, and maybe bison. See how that goes. Then they did a 500-acre bull hog treatment near Pine Springs. They completed two seedings, one on Tabby Mountain, one on the phosphate mine. You can see the one up on the phosphate mine up on just off the Highway 191. They replaced a couple of guzzlers with the modern tanks in Kyle Basin for stock and wildlife. Our aquatic section, as I reported the last time, finished their middle fork of the Sheep Creek treatment, and actually we were able to get in 47 Colorado cuts. They're really, really hard to come by, and we're excited to be able to get those and actually get them into water. And so hopefully everything will continue to go along well at that point. They've also finished their trend netting studies up at Starvation for rainbow and walleye. They netted a lot of really good fish. They looked really good and healthy. I actually was able to go out and work with them in one day, and there's some really nice, healthy, strong fish out there. Up on the Flaming Gorge, they just finished netting for burbot and got high numbers on that, and they tagged a bunch of those fish for the burbot bash, and catch as many as you can and check it out. There's opportunity to make good money if you can catch a tagged fish, so that's gone well. The wildlife section, one really neat thing that we're able to do this year with the wildlife section, working with SFW, is we were able to put out roughly 4,000 pheasants by the time we're done here in this region. This isn't statewide, this is just in the region. We're really excited at that opportunity of being able to work with them and get those birds out. And they went out onto our WMAs, our wildlife management areas, and our walk-in access areas that we have in the region. So it's been really, really nice. And two-thirds of those 4,000 birds, roughly, were purchased by SFW, working with us on getting those out. And we're really excited at the opportunity to partner up and work with these guys and get stuff like that out.
Did we utilize the day-old chick program at all?
We did a little bit in the region. There was a far less interest than what we thought we would get on that. Of course, on the day-old chick program, there's certain things they had to have and follow, and probably made it a little bit more difficult. But I was told that there was an estimated survival of 60% of the day-old chicks that went out. We're also going to look at this coming year at including chuckers in that as well. So that'll be really cool. And we'll get some of them out, but we really received a lot of positive feedback, happy people at seeing a lot of pheasants out there, so we're pretty happy about that. On our deer check stations, some of our check stations had a little bit higher number of deer that were checked through this year, so that's seemed to bring in additional happy people. So we're just going to start our post-season deer classification counts. And my wildlife manager, Dax Mangus, asked me to let you guys know that you're invited, if you want to go out and on a morning or an evening and classify deer with them. You get to ride in the cab. And if you're really good, you might even get you a pair of binoculars if you can't bring your own. But you're welcome to. I have a schedule. He's even gone around with his biologists, and he's got a schedule here. And if you'll get with me, I will get you. I don't know the best way to do this, but I I do have a schedule here, so get with me. If you want to go out, we'd love to take you out and let you see how they classify deer, and they'll even show you where they classify deer. You might, they're probably not there during the deer hunt, but they're down starting to get all ready and excited, and so they're in a few different spots than what they normally would, but you're welcome to do that. And I have the schedule for that right here. Let's see, outreach. I talked about the pheasants. He's done a really good job of putting out news releases of letting people know about where these pheasants are going, how many are going, and working with their dedicated hunters. He's roughly done around 5,000 volunteer hours. So, in closing, the last thing, just to give you a heads up, our big game coordinator, we had a change in Salt Lake, who was a niece, Audi, has changed. Niece has moved on, and we now have this young buck sitting right here in front of us here. His name's Justin, and Justin Shannon, and he's our new big game coordinator, and he'd be more than happy to answer any questions from you. If you have questions that we're not able to answer here in the region or anything to do with statewide issues, stuff like that. So, but Justin's our man. And known Justin, he came to us from the southeast region. So he's been with us for a while. So I think that's everything, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Well, looks like we'll start out with Justin and give us a presentation on bucks bowls. Let's see, we've got mint rules and deer transplant size.
Okay. Well, thanks for that introduction, Boyd. And I would just ask that you be gentle. Let's see, tonight I'm going to give a presentation on the 2014 bucks bulls and once-in-a-lifetime season dates, hunt structure, and some rule changes. To begin, I want to talk about deer hunt recommendations first. So for the general season hunt, essentially all we did was move the dates up one day to avoid a Sunday start. And so archery hunts will be from August 16th to September 12th. Muzzleloader will be from September 24th to October 2nd. And any weapon will be that third Saturday in October, October 18th through the 26th. For elk, the six general season hunt dates we have are as follows. Archery spike bull, we're recommending a start date of August 16th and ending September 5th. For archery, any bulls, same start date, but end September 12th. For the any weapon hunt, we go recommending October 4th through the 16th. Muzzleloader, October 29th through November 6th. Youth any bull, September 13th through the 21st, and the late youth any bull, November 29th through January 15th. The way I'd like to present this tonight is I want to talk about those recommendations that have statewide implications, and after that, go and discuss unit recommendations that are pertinent to the various regions. So our first recommendation statewide is to update Rule 657-5, which is the big game rule. And we want to change this definition that any person 17 years of age or younger on July 31st would qualify as a youth. This date was chosen because we don't have any other big game, upland game, or waterfowl hunts occurring at this time. And what we'd like to do is roll this out for big game and then come back through the rack and board process and standardize the definition of youth for all hunts. Right now it's different for waterfowl and upland game and even big game. And so we're going to standardize it for big game now and come back through the process and standardize it as a whole. That's something that we feel really good about and think would add clarity to our programs. The next recommendation is we recommend adding an addendum to the statewide deer plan, which will, one, allow for mule deer transplants, and then, two, it'll list potential release sites. And these release sites are as follows. The Box Elder, the 9 Mile, the San Juan Elk Ridge, the Wasatch Mountains, West Desert West, Southwest Desert, Oak Creek, the Pavant, and Mount Dutton. And those are graphed on the right for you over there. And the reason we chose these units is we wanted, we wanted to have some diversity in release sites for mule deer. And so we have some West Desert stuff. We have some stuff in central Utah and southeast and some of this 9 Mile, some of that area. And the idea is that, I don't know if we would necessarily fill all these units with deer with transplants, but as we transplant deer and open this door and go down this road, we wanted to make sure we had an eclectic group of release sites so we can match deer habitats that we're trapping deer in to a potential release site. And what a lot of these have in common is they're away from urban areas, have good winter range that historically held more deer, things like that. Another recommendation, this is an update from the Wildlife Board. In May of 2013, the southern region was given an action item to determine if the Monroe unit required a different hunt strategy. In October, the southern region went and met with the sportsmen down there, and there were a lot of concerns over spike harvest. If you're not familiar with the Monroe, it's an interesting unit. It falls in the middle of what we call a metapopulation, which is where you have elk going from one unit to the next freely. So essentially with the Fish Lake, the Monroe, the Dutton, and the Boulder, you have a big population of elk that roams those areas. And as an agency, we've carved out up those areas and said, here's the Dutton, here's the Monroe. And on the Monroe, if you look at the data with that, we're taking a disproportionate amount of spikes in the harvest. If you look at the unit as a whole, we're probably doing okay, but there were a lot of concerns, and this is the thing that we were asked to go back and meet with the sportsmen in Ridgefield with. And at this meeting that we were at in October, there were a few options given. One was to eliminate spike hunting for the entire unit, and the sportsmen down there were really in favor of that. The other one was to eliminate spike hunting just for the any weapon portion of the hunt, so you can still have archery, muzzleloader, those types of things, but not any weapon. And then, as always, in the recommendation process, the status quo or no change is always an option. On November 7th at the last board meeting, the Southern Region went back and reported what they found on this action item. And tonight and throughout this process, what we're recommending is to eliminate any weapon spike elk hunting on the Monroe until the next two years, which is essentially when the next statewide elk plan is revisited. Again, it's only for the any weapon portion, so it's kind of that compromise between status quo and doing away with it altogether. Okay, another recommendation has statewide implications. We recommend allowing archery hunting of big game on select waterfowl management areas. These include Bicknell Bottoms, Browns Park, Clear Lake, Desert Lake, Locomotive Springs, and Redmond. The idea here is our waterfowl seasons don't start until October, and we have some archery hunts in August and September where we have mule deer and pronghorn that are living on division-owned property. So we wanted to provide a little more big game hunting opportunity and still maintaining the conflict with waterfowl hunters, and we think we can do that with this recommendation. And then finally, for statewide recommendations, we recommend altering Rule 657-5, the big game rule again, to allow for the use of crossbows, draw locks, and magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders during the any weapon hunts only. And we also recommend altering Rule 657-12 to align with the changes in the big game rule. In 657-12, that deals with crossbows and scopes and things like that. While we have that rule open, we wanted to update some things, some definitions, some examples to just do some basic housekeeping. For example, we wanted to delete the definition of highway. It's defined, yet it's never used in the rule. We give a lengthy definition of what resident is in the rule, but it's redundant because it's already outlined in code. And we use terms like valid application, which our agency just simply doesn't use anymore. So it's just to clean it up a little bit. We also provide definitions and minimum requirements for crossbows and draw locks. Okay, now for regional recommendations. In the southern region, we recommend modifying the Pine Valley Virgin River Bighorn Sheep boundary to be consistent with the deer, elk, and pronghorn unit boundaries. What we have are bighorn sheep that are going outside of the bighorn boundary, and so we just wanted to standardize that for all big game and allow for hunting opportunity there. We recommend modifying the Panguitch Lake pronghorn boundary to account for an expanding pronghorn population. Again, we have pronghorn that are doing well and they're growing, and they've fallen outside of our hunt boundary, and we want to account for that. And then finally, we recommend modifying the Mountain Dutton and the Ponsagon and the Parker Mountain pronghorn boundaries to avoid overharvest of the Johns Valley herd. This probably requires a little bit of explaining. For those that don't know, the Parker Mountain is, we have more pronghorn permits than anywhere else in the state in that unit. And in that unit, we have a population called Johns Valley. And we have so many, and it falls within that unit boundary. So what we want to do is carve it out of that, the Parker Mountain, and include it with the neighboring Mountain Dutton and Ponsagon, which has a lot fewer permits. And so that way we can avoid over-harvest of that population. Okay, for the southeast region, we recommend splitting the 9 mile Range Creek Bighorn Sheep Hunt into an early and a late. Each will be roughly 15 days in November. The idea behind this is this unit has very limited access. There's one road that takes you into the heart of the sheep country, but it has the most permits in the state. We upwards to 20 hunters at one time, and so we just want to space them out temporarily. So. In the northern region, we recommend modifying the season dates on the Grass Creek Limited Entry Elk Hunt with the standard September 13th through the 21st, and then also include an October 4th through the 28th. Additionally, we want to include an archery and a muzzleloader season to increase bull harvest in this unit. For the Cache Ogden and Morgan Southridge, we recommend combining these units for pronghorn hunting to allow for more areas to hunt if pronghorn stay on private lands, which can happen in those areas. In the northeast region, we recommend expanding the boundary for the Uinta Basin extended archery deer and elk hunt to target resident big game that are living in low elevation agricultural lands. We also recommend creating a new bison hunt on the Butte Cliffs. We're excited about that. And then we also recommend splitting the Butte Cliffs limited entry deer hunt into a north and south units during the any weapon hunt. So for archery and muzzleloader, that you can hunt the entire unit, but for any weapon, those would be split into north and south. And this is an effort to address discrepancies in the buck to doe ratios that have been presented and brought up at RACs for I don't know how many years, but a long, long time. So this is our approach to address that. In the central region, we recommend removing bull elk from the San Pete Valley extended archery elk hunt. Recommend adding a Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Hunt for units 16A and 17A. That's essentially Mount Timpanogos, Rock Canyon, and Mount Nebo. And then finally, for mountain goats, we recommend combining the Wasatch Mountains, Box Elder Peak, Lone Peak, and Timpanogos into one unit. And this is to address movements in mountain goats between these units. And sometimes we surveyed that, and they moved from one area to the other. We didn't want to be selling guys camping trips, and so we wanted to make sure there were goats to be had when we issued permits. Some key dates to be presented tonight for your consideration. For the big game drawn for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime, and the dedicated hunter applicants, that'll occur from January 30th through March 6th. But if you just want to apply for a bonus point or preference point, the deadline is up until March 20th, and those results will be posted by May 30th of 2014. For lifetime license holders, they will automatically be assigned the unit they had the previous year. If they want to make changes to that, those are due March 6th as well. And those that didn't hunt in 2013 and fail to choose a unit by the deadline can obtain a leftover permit if they're available. This last slide deals with season date extensions for our hunters with disabilities. I won't go into each detail unless there are specific questions, but essentially what we've tried to do is give 5 days prior or post-season of the hunt that they're eligible for. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. Good questions from the RAC. Questions from RAC, Justin? Go ahead.
Yeah, Justin, let's go to the the boundary change on the Brush Creek. I got a couple questions.
Okay.
2 years ago, I guess it was I think 2 years ago. That was all in it was all in the extended hunt, and it was it was all taken out because of the migratory animals.
Wait, for which unit? The Grass Creek? Is that what you said?
No, the Brush Creek.
Extended. I thought it's a northern region action. Okay, where are we at? The northeast region?
Northeast region.
Okay.
It's the extended archery out on the Brush Creek area. That was taken out 2 years ago because of migratory animal issues. And now you're bringing it back. What has changed? Why are they extending it back now if they took it out 2 years ago?
Sure, I can speak big picture, and then Dax, you may need to chime in. The spirit of this recommendation is to try to target big game that are causing depredation, that are living in these areas year-round and causing some problems. This specific drainage, I don't know if I can speak to you, Dax, if you need to address that.
Yeah, you guys maybe remember 2 years ago, there was some concern that that extended archery hunters were perhaps harvesting deer that were migrating down off Diamond Mountain Limited Entry Unit in that area. There were some law enforcement issues with enforcing the boundary where it was a 1 mile buffer from Brush Creek below the dam there. We took it out and then had a lot of feedback this last year from landowners along Brush Creek with, that were frustrated that owned property on both sides of the creek and could have extended archery hunting on deer on one side of the creek and not the other. So we went back and looked at it and said, the new boundary we're proposing doesn't include the stuff in Brush Creek above the Island Park Road. So from the Island Park Road down south down to the Green River, we included both sides of Brush Creek to address concerns from landowners in those areas that were having depredation problems with deer in their fields. And that still lets us avoid kind of right there where the Diamond Mountain Road takes off and the substation is and stuff. That's where a lot of the concern was that we had possibly extended archery hunters harvesting Diamond Mountain bucks. That's kind of the rationale behind the recommendation. Does that answer your question?
Answers that. I have another question. The private ground and farms above the Brush Creek Ridge and Trail were in the last extended unit, and they haven't been included in this. Any reason why they weren't included? Is it just a boundary issue?
It's partially a boundary issue, partially because that's where the concern about harvesting Diamond Mountain bucks was that prompted the change 2 years ago. That's why when we made this change, we felt like, if we're below this Island Park Road, we're not going to have the boundary issues and the potential for harvesting, deer that may be coming off Diamond Mountain. But it's based on, concerns that landowners brought to us a couple years ago. And then these new concerns further downstream there in Brush Creek.
Okay, last question. Now, I know the people above the ridge would like to get back the extended archery hunt because it's one of our tools, one of our depredation tools. This isn't set in stone for like 2 or 3 years, is it? If we was to come to the fishing game the next year, give it the Diamond Mountain landowners, give it to you guys, it's something that could be worked on. In other words, we're not going to be told this is set for 4 years.
No, the boundaries could be adjusted every year.
Okay.
Unless I'm wrong, I think we can change a boundary in any year if we need to.
So we've got time to work on it and talk about the issues and through the next year. Okay.
Yeah, it'd be this rack next year if you want to make a change.
That answers my question.
Dax, stay up. Where's your dividing line on the north-south split on the Buck Cliff Deer?
Cliff, you want to talk to that just a little bit? Clint's our biologist there in the Buck Cliffs. I know he's been coordinating with Brad Crompton, who's the biologist on this, that kind of does the classification work on the south. Clint can explain that a little bit.
We went with the Roldis boundary to the divide road. To the county line, to the Colorado border, and north to the White River for the north boundary. And so the southern unit will include everything south of that. And we included the roadless along with the northern unit to keep people from coming up the southern side, to keep coming up Hay Canyon or East Canyon, and then having to travel all the way to the roadless area that way for access, because there are a handful of deer that stay up on top, and so I figured it'd help keep everybody a little more honest if we just took that away and made it a little bit easier for the northern region guys and southern guys to stay separate.
Have you come up with a percentage split of what you're going to do with the permits on the north and the south?
Not anything not set in stone. Yet. That'll be the RAC meeting in the spring.
April.
Thank you.
Any other questions on RAC?
On the bison down at Book Cliffs, what's the, how big is it now, and what's the target number for that herd?
I think the objective is 425, if I remember right.
450.
450. I was just being generous there. And then the, I think we're roughly 100 miles or so.
How many did we actually plant, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when we did that?
Oh, I think it was 71, if I remember, on the two different transplants from the Henry Mountains. I think we did a group of 40 and a group of 31.
And we did have some of the animals that we transplanted to the unit went over and went over to Ute tribal lands. So they didn't all stay on the public lands part of the Brookwest.
So they've grown 30% or so.
And most of the animals we brought were young, and bison don't have really high, they don't have as many offspring as some other species, and they're longer lived species. And most of the animals we brought were young and weren't breeding age. So, but now I think production should start picking up in that herd.
Dan, do you have a question?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, Justin. the first question is, what is the rationale for changing the archery hunting in Sanpete Valley, no more bulls? What was the rationale for that?
Yeah, so the idea behind that is that unit is a part of the Manti unit as a whole, and the Manti is we manage for a 5.5 to 6 year old bull, but there's some quality animals on that unit. And historically, we had more quality than we do now by design. We've taken that down, and what the central region's heard for quite a while is, there's really a lack of alignment with the division's recommendation, because you're managing for these animals that take 18, 20 years to draw, or whatever that time period is, yet you turn around and allow archers to hunt them over the counter. And so there was a lot of, it was more of a social issue than anything, just, questioning the region. What are you really managing for? Opportunity? And so we it's more of a social recommendation than anything, but that's...
So not really a management objective issue.
No.
Yeah. Okay. The other question I have is on the allowing archery hunting in those waterfowl management, those selected waterfowl management areas.
Yeah.
Are all six of those areas within units that are at management objective already? For deer, for example.
No, not necessarily. I can think of Desert Lake. That deer population isn't at objective. What it is, though, is it's division on lands. And a lot of times archers have approached us and said, we know there's bucks to be had on your property, or there's pronghorn, in another example. Why aren't we allowed to hunt it? In the past, it was because of overlap with water columns, but one starts in October and one's occurring in August, September. So we took a long, hard look at it and said, yeah, this is probably something that we can provide these people that want to spend more time on our WMAs, and we wouldn't have the perceived conflict. So. But we're not at objective on all those deer units.
My concern is just that there are there are just so many hunts. There are just so many hunts, and for those units that are already struggling, below management objective, it just seems like adding more pressure. That's my concern. Is that?
Well, in some ways it could release pressure, because it's not adding a hunt. These archery hunts already exist. They're already on the books. What it is it's allowing another place to go, and so it's actually relieving pressure on other areas. So the permits probably won't change. It's just providing more boundary.
Any other questions from the board? The RAC. Okay. Questions from the public. If you come up and state your name. Any questions from the public?
I'm Joey Draper. I'm just curious on the buffalo units and book list. If you guys had there's a Flat Rock and Wild Horse unit, How come you guys don't open up any on the east side of Willow Creek?
Dax, you want to tackle that one?
Come on. Just a curiosity question.
We're actually recommending the new hunt that would include the entire unit. So it would include the stuff east, east of Willow Creek. The hunt we have now is that Wild Horse Bench, Agency Drop, Flat Rock Backcountry. And that's really, it's late. A lot of bison will migrate down into there off the tribe. And so we have that hunt to harvest some of those animals. And this new hunt will include the entire Book Cliffs. So it'll give us an opportunity to start harvesting some of these bulls that live on public lands year round.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the public at all? We've got two comments on these items, on item five. Stoney, did you want to get up and address this variance letter?
No, I think that's been postponed until the 18th.
Oh, it's number seven, not number five. Okay. Yeah, let me put that as seven. That's okay. Okay, Stan Baker, item five.
Yeah, Stan Baker, I'm representing Mule Deer Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Regional Advisory Council on the subject of amending the statewide management plan for the mule deer. Trapping and translocation of big game has been used by wildlife managers to achieve many objectives, including restoring wildlife populations to historical ranges, augmenting populations at low densities, and reducing overpopulation. Examples of successful trap and translocation programs include the restoration of elk, pronghorn, bighorn sheep, and wild turkeys across North America during the 20th century. Restoration of mule deer through translocation has been used to bring populations back to historical ranges in Texas and Mexico. MDF believes that one of the keys to reversing the decline of mule deer in Utah and throughout their historic range is for state wildlife agencies to finally find the missing component, which will result in the ability to successfully transplant mule deer. MDF applauds the current trap and transplant study currently underway in southern Utah. MDF believes that the current study has answered several important questions that will aid in ensuring that future transplants will be more successful. MDF has contributed several million dollars through the conservation tag program, improving mule deer habitat statewide. We believe that these habitat projects have had a major impact on one of the factors involved in declining mule deer populations, the loss of habitat. No other western state has been as aggressive as the state of Utah in restoring habitat. We ask that the RACs recommend the DWR add to the amendment that predator control occur prior to any transplant operation, primarily on coyotes and cougars. If this is not the appropriate place, then we would recommend it be added into each individual transplant proposal. Managers should develop a trap and translocation management plan that includes a monitoring component to determine the effectiveness of the program. More information that is available to managers, the more successful will be the transplants. MDF supports the amendment and stands ready to provide volunteers to aid DWR in the trapping and transport to the release sites. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your comments. Okay, we as a RAC, you got items you want to discuss or debate that have been proposed and given to us here at this time?
I have a question on this letter that you just read for Dax or somebody. Is there predator control associated with translocation programs now, or is it, who would answer that?
Yeah, this came up last night at our RAC meeting. It's something we're willing to commit to. I mean, when we do these transplants, we want to give these populations the best chance they have to succeed. And when we moved deer in the southern region last year, it's an effort we undertook, and we'll do it moving forward.
What will that look like? I mean, what kind of an effort is that going to be as far as the cougar and the coyotes?
Yeah, I guess it would be more focused on coyotes than anything. Cougars, they're, you know, where cougars are protected wildlife and a game species, and we have they recommendations come through the RAC and board process with that. I don't know if much of that would change, but for coyotes, what we found by moving deer this last year is when we put them there on the range in January, they didn't move much the first few months, and so we feel like it would be a smaller area to target. And then when they hit that green up, the resident deer went to the summer range. Or the, if that's you, Dax. Anyways, the movements of these deer just hasn't been much, and so if we were to do predator control, it would be in a fairly small area. So.
Okay.
Any other discussion of the items that have been presented? Anything at all? Is it time to discuss it or debate it or whatever? So, any other questions?
I guess I have one more. Do we need to add that if we have a motion that we include predator control in the translocation programs?
Technically, wouldn't it be a recommendation that we make? Because it's not an action item, we can't make a vote on it or make a movement on it. However, we can make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board that it be included in any translocation plan. However, from what it sounds like, the division is already committed to making that appropriation of their plan. However, does that satisfy the constituent? Or would you like to see that written?
Last night at the Southeast RAC, they included it in their motion to part of the amendment that predator control be part of that.
To is which that, proposal do you recall?
So to the transplant plan. Yeah, basically what they do. Okay.
Yeah, as part of the amendment to that they would do predator control on those specific sites. And on those specific release sites prior to the transplant.
Interesting. I guess I see it in two senses. Presently, under your management plans and doing these things, you're taking into consideration all those aspects. Correct? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, a lot of the release sites already have, they already fall under predator management areas. I think what, I don't want to speak for you, but the way I interpret it is, if we know we're going to release them in a given drainage, go give that a shot of predator control prior to the release. Is that the
spirit? That's correct.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's...
For what duration
yeah.
are you looking for? From a biological standpoint, correct me if I'm wrong, wouldn't that have to be an extended period of time to actually contain the predator population between 2 and 3 years prior to translocation to actually diminish the population?
It depends on what scale you want to tackle that. Yeah, I mean that's a good point. Scale's important. And this is tough, too, because a lot of this effort is if we get deer in hand, say we have situations where it's just not socially acceptable to have lethal removal. And we got to go in and get deer. This is something we commit to do to the best of our ability. I don't know if we have a lot of release sites.
My concern, sir, and to speak to you, I happen to know if you kill pups, the bitch will immediately reproduce and go into reproduction mode, and you can actually increase the population unless you control it to a certain degree. And from the research that I've done, it would be a 75% removal rate for about 3 years. In order to actually start to diminish that population, and don't quote me on that, but that's from my understanding of my study and research on predator control. So what you're talking about is a little ambiguous and hard to make a proposal in terms of that because we don't know the time frame or the population control that you're looking for. So we need to be a little more specific with that to make a motion.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You have to realize, of course, we don't have a lot of background information. We're into this 1 year.
Right.
On a one translocation in Utah on the Pavant area. And So, and what we're talking about primarily is, you know, they're going to be releasing on winter range area. These deer are going to move.
Absolutely.
And so, and we don't have the science, and we don't have the recommendation to present the science of how big of an area and how long should that last. We're going to leave all that at the discretion of DWR. And again, in my comments, we'd just like to see a real careful monitoring. We'd like to use this as a research in itself and see what works the best. So.
Well, and I think in terms of that, you know, leaving it at the discretion of the division is a very fine statement. And I would like to kind of mimic that here for a minute. I understand that the cost of transporting one deer is exponential. And there's no way we're going to broadcast these animals into a location where they're bait for coyotes. So I think leaving it at the discretion of the division is probably where I would stand. And I don't know if there's any other discussion regarding that, but I doubt we'd cast that much money into a project just to watch them become food for predators.
Go ahead. Question and observation. I would think that when the fish and game, when you guys look at these areas, you study them for quite a period of time, I imagine, before you do a transplant. Don't you? Aren't they the area you're going to transplant to? Isn't it studied over a period of time? Habitat, predators.
We don't do a lot of predator studies, but all the units that we proposed as possible release sites in our region are under predator management, where we'll do aerial gunning for coyotes, remove coyotes, and these are efforts wildlife specific in addition to anything that's done for livestock on those units. We have range trend monitoring sites on these units where we look at range conditions. The units we recommended in our region are areas where historically we had more deer, and based on our assessments of the habitat, we feel like the habitat is there to support more deer, but for whatever reason, our numbers are down. We feel like, these are places where the deer could have a good fighting chance to survive. Transplants of mule deer is a relatively new thing, and we're committed to do the best we can to make them successful, but we don't have a whole lot of background information on exactly how it's going to work. And but we're committed to do the best we can with it and to keep close watch on and see if it's effective and see if it's a tool that can help us with mule deer management in the state.
Not to date myself, Dax, but I remember trapping deer and transplanting when I was about 3 years old. This is not a new study. This is not a new project, but from what I understand, it has not been wildly successful in the past.
Justin can maybe speak to that better than me.
For mule deer, because they're a relatively weak species.
Sure. The survival rates of mule deer transplants are markedly lower than other big game species. But with that said, what we're trying to do if we move forward with this effort, we want to learn from it. And so, when we started moving bighorn sheep, we were killing every other one that we had in hand. And so, I think by doing it, you learn a lot from it. We're committed to get better with it and things like that and try to understand what the limiting factors are. So it's a door we'd like to open.
Well, it is my understanding from that one Pavant. My name again?
Yes, please.
Okay, Stan Baker, Mule Deer Foundation.
Thank you, sir.
That's all right. From the one Pavant that's under our belt, basically, in Utah, which isn't a lot of research to hang your hat on at this point, but, it's been widely discussed that deer don't do well with transplants. From that one Pavant release last winter, it looks like they survived. The stress factor was not what killed the deer. It was the predators after they hit the ground. Now, they tagged both resident and the released animals, and the higher incidence of predation was on the newly released ones. Again, this isn't a lot of research data, but we'd like to really see the division take a look and see if there is some mythology that we can use to further this. There's areas, again, that are lacking deer, and they have adequate winter habitat, but their deer numbers are very low. So that's all we're asking. Yeah. Let's take a look at it.
Take every precaution.
I have one more question.
Go ahead.
One more. What's the cost? Moving deer.
Moving deer.
What's the cost? The cost of moving deer.
My phone is on silent and vibrating. I don't know what is going on, so we're going to shut that thing.
We'll take it from you.
Please do. The cost, it depends. I mean, the cost varies. And what I mean by that is with deer, we have the potential to drop net these animals where we can bait a man, and at that point it's relatively low. With helicopter costs, you can catch a lot of them in a short amount of time, and so it's lower than other big game. I'm $275-$300 if we were to use a helicopter. But there's a lot of different methods we'd like to explore. So to say that if we move 50 deer, this is going to be the cost.
So the total cost, including personnel and time and actual capture costs and transportation.
It's going to be relatively each project, because the most expensive is going to be the capture if you use a helicopter.
You're looking at that, it's just 350 ahead to capture them.
Potentially, yeah.
What is the success rate of what currently?
The success survival rates.
And reproduction rates following.
Yeah, so those are hard questions to answer because we're not even the first year through the study, so I think it's premature to really say this has worked or it hasn't worked. But of the 102 deer that were collared and translocated, I know of 44 mortalities, so you're 50-60% survival rates. And then production, I spoke with the principal investigator out of BYU of that research today, and he says they're seeing reproduction, they're seeing these collared translocated deer, but they have fawns at the hook on their heels right now as well, which is...
That's great.
So, I mean, but again, it's just too early to really say one way or the other, but those are the data behind it.
So it leads to one more question, then. Where are they coming from?
What we presented were release sites, just because to capture them, we could have potentially a lot of locations. One area we're looking at is an area like Antelope Island, where they have a lot of deer on them right now. Hunting may not be socially an acceptable management tool out there, and so it's an area we want to get better. Some of these urban settings, I think, could be an option as well this winter, and we're looking to move some off the Parowan Front again, similar to what we did last year. So we're hoping to get some more experience with
them. So you won't move anything from an area that doesn't meet objective levels then? Or is that not a fair statement?
I think what we're looking at is areas that habitats that are being severely damaged, regardless of what the objective is. I think that's something our agency doesn't want to see, is habitat damage, or situations where lethal removal just may not be socially acceptable anymore. So those would kind of be the criteria we follow.
Mr. Chairman, you didn't mention it, but doesn't your wildlife groups like Sportsman for Wildlife and Mule Deer Foundation help with a lot of these transplants as far as finances?
Yeah, financially, yeah. The deer we translocated last year, they covered the entire cost for that. So it's not like taxpayer dollars or anything like that.
Good discussion, Ted.
Sure. You mentioned the 40% mortality rate. Do you have any idea how many of those were predator kills and what was the predator?
Yeah. That's a good question. It was interesting because initially we thought when we put them there we'd see a lot of mortality. That wasn't the case. The first few months we didn't have a lot of that. But later on, as they started traveling, especially to their summer ranges or these translocated deer were just trying to figure out their new habitats, yeah, there were a lot of mortalities, and a lot of it was predator related. We feel like we potentially had some poaching issues as well. There've been several different cause-specific mortalities that occurred, but predation is certainly one of them.
And what was the predator? Coyotes?
It was both coyotes and cougars, yeah. And sometimes they couldn't tell, but they just said predation for sure.
Mitch, was there something over there you want to share, discussion with the board, or? Sorry.
Trying to stay out of trouble.
You're John. No, I didn't know. No, that's okay. That's what we're here for, is to kind of discuss and see what I mean brought out on the table. Is there any other discussion?
There was a little bit of ambiguity, if you don't mind, on the slide regarding R657-12, subsection 4, about the use of crossbows during muzzleloader season. as well as variable scopes. Right there.
This one?
Mm-hmm. During any weapon hunts only?
Yeah.
So can they use crossbows during the current muzzleloader season?
No.
Okay. Excellent.
But what we're trying to do is just be a little bit more liberal with the term any weapon. And what we have is, you know, right now, on an any weapon hunt, you can have your 15 power scope on a 300 big rifle, but if you put that same scope on a muzzleloader, suddenly it's illegal.
Right.
And so we're just trying to say, let's open this up.
Can I address that?
Yes.
Carry on that, Tori Christofferson. What we're trying to do is, if you look at all the western states, we are one of the only ones that did not allow that, whether it be scope, muzzleloader, or crossbow during the any weapon hunt. So we're just trying to liberalize that, open it up for more opportunity, but it would only be for the any weapon.
I just wanted a little bit of clarification. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any further discussion? Call for a motion.
I move to accept as presented by the state.
I'll second it.
A motion by Carrie and seconded by Randy. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous? Okay. Thank you. Let's go to the CWMU management plans and commit numbers. Scott Farm.
Scott McFarland, I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the state. And this evening I will be presenting the 2014 Buck and Bull CWMU and Landowner Association recommendations. Just to begin with, for the CWMUs, I'll start with the CWMU portion first. For the CWMUs, we basically receive three types of applications every year. New applications are just that, they're brand new. Applications that have never been a CWMU, but they could also be applications for CWMUs that have changed ownership or acreage more than 34%. That kicks them into a new category. They have to reapply if that happens during the year. Renewal applications, all of our CWMUs are on a three-year application time period, and they're required every 3 years to renew those if they wish to stay in the program. Excuse me. And change applications that are amendments to the current applications that have been approved that require board action. And to report RAC and board action, any change in permit numbers or change in the permit allocation or the public-private ratio of permits or any change in season dates requires action by the RAC and the board. For 2014, we received four new applications. Two were due to land ownership changes greater than 34%. We had two brand new applications. 13 of the CWMUs required renewal for the 2014 to 2016 period. And 8 CWMUs submitted change applications requiring RAC and board approval. If all of them were approved, they would bring their total to 119 CWMUs in the state for the 2014 hunting season. Like I said, this is an overview of the CWMUs within the state. There'd be, if they were approved, all were approved, they would bring the total to 119. 72 of those are in the northern region, 5 in the northeastern region, 12 in the 7 in the central region, 17 southeastern region, and 13 in the southern region. This would bring the total to over 2.16 million acres enrolled in the CWMU program, and 96% of that is private land. and about 446 private landowners participate in the program currently. So the total numbers for 2014 season, and this is going to change slightly, and I'll come back to that, but basically we have the private and public splits on those for buck deer management, deer, bull elk, buck pronghorn, and bull moose, bringing a total of 2,938 private permits and 469 public permits, which represent 14% of the total permits. So I'll go quickly through the recommendations by region. The northern region had three new applications. Grouse Creek and Hart's Gravel were previously in the CWB program. They did change ownership greater than 34%, so it kicked them into the new category again. They had to reapply. And we recommend approval of both of those CWMUs. The TL Bar Ranch is a brand new one. It's for pronghorn. It's in Box Elder County. We recommend approval of that. That's CWMU also. I think there's nine of these. There's eight or nine of in the northern region that were renewal. These ones that were at the end of their 3-year application period. And the Blue Creek, Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Jacobs Creek, Lazy H Ranch, Mountain Top, Neal Creek, Steelman Creek Ranch, TJ Cattle Company, Wooders Creek South, are all renewed applications, and we recommend approval of all these applications also. The change applications, White's Valley, there's been a change on that. We had a calculation error on the number of permits that excluded the compensation for private land, so they've come back and amended their change application again. What they would like to do, instead of requesting 13 total permits, they wanted to decrease their permits. They originally requested 13 total, with 11 and 2, but that did not include compensation for public land that was in that unit. So they've amended that, and they're requesting a total of 10 permits, which would be 8 private and 2 public, and that does give an extra permit for the inclusion of public land within that unit. The Deseret CWMU added 4,489 private acres. They included some of their neighbors to their north and west to help compensate them for providing critical winter range, and they increased permits to help compensate those people. They also wanted to change their elk private-public ratio from 85-15 to a 90-10 split. And what that does is, at a 90-10 split, that allows the public to get 100% of the antlerless permits that are available for that unit, which is currently at, I think it's 260 permits which are available. So all those will go to the public. Washakie, and New Core West, and Ingham Peak. They're all changing. They're either decreasing or increasing buck deer numbers. We recommend approval of those. Ingham Peak requested to add elk to their application. They've got growing elk populations out there, and they are requesting a total of 6 permits, with 4 and 2 to 4 private and 2 public. The extra permit there is because of the inclusion of public land. We recommend approval of all those. Southeastern region applications. Spring Canyon is a new application. It was previously a CWMU years ago. Included in another CWMU years ago. It's a deer one. We're recommending denial of the application because of insufficient contiguous acreage. They're asking to include some public land that really doesn't qualify under our rule, and if that is included, it would do it, but it doesn't fit the rule. And if there's questions about that, I do have a map I can explain that. Red Ranches is renewal. There's no changes from the previous application. We recommend approval of that. Minimod Ridge, this is something that requires action on the we recommend approval of the application without the inclusion of a trust section two. This was pulled out about 3 years ago from at the request of the Wildlife Board, and they're at there. The CWMU is asking to put that back in. There is public access to it through private lands, but it was previously requested to be taken out. And the numbers would change depending on what is approved for that. And without the state section, the landowner permits would be 36 on deer, 36 elk, and 4 deer and 4 elk. And with it, there would be an additional two deer permits and 1 elk permit if that is included in that. Southern region applications, there's southeastern, the last two on there is Emma Park and Schofield Canyon. Those are change in renewal applications. One decreased their acreage on their renewal. It was a slight change, and the other one wants to decrease. Schofield Canyon wants to decrease their buck deer permits from 20 to 10. And we recommend approval of both of those. Southern region applications, there's Black Point as a renewal application. We recommend approval. There's no changes from the previous application. Oak Ranch, this is another one that was, there was a clerical letter on the inclusion of public land. There was not a permit to compensate for that. So what they requested to do is go back to withdraw their change application, and they will go back to a total of 19 permits, a 16-3 split, which does compensate for the private or the public lands that are included in that unit. Central region applications, there was just one. It's a change application to add one private elk permit to their current total, and it was 6, and they're requesting 7 with a 6-1 split, and we recommend approval of that. Thank you. That's the end of the CWMU portion of my presentation.
Thank you, sir. Questions from the rack?
I've got one there on that mini mod ridge. You said section two was taken out. Is that, help me understand, is that why, is that because the public already had access into there and it was allowing the public to have access during the hunting season? Is that why that was removed? Is that why the Wildlife Board made that change?
That's correct. They and as this was explained last night, what happened was apparently it's a good section for hunting. Otherwise, there's no benefit to the CWMU except for as an additional, probably pretty good hunting ground. They're wanting to include it with the addition of two more public deer permits and one public elk permit. The reason it was taken out before was because there was public access. The landowners did allow public, not free access, but it was no charge, but they limited the number that went in there. But when people would ask, they would limit the number of people for no charge to go through their property to access those state sections, so that state section. So that it was basically, there is public access. It's not unlimited public access, but there was public access through the private lands for the public to get to that. And that's why it was originally taken out.
Any other questions?
This region, the northeastern region, seems to have a disproportionately low number of CWMUs, only 5. I'm just wondering why that is, and is there something that the region is doing to try to encourage more CWMUs?
I don't think it's a, I guess I couldn't answer that. I don't know why it has a disproportionate number. There were no changes, or there were no applications for any changes in the current.
I'm just curious. It jumped out at me.
I'll back or start for Dan. Essentially, it's large contiguous pieces of private property. It's really only a value to be a CWMU if you are surrounded by a limited entry unit. And so in our region too, Diamond Mountain maybe would have been, but instead they've gone through the landowner association process instead. And so the majority of the large contiguous pieces that we have that are surrounded by land limit entry units, so that you have quality animals that they can really market well, those are everything that's really fits the description, the criteria, is a CWB for the most part in our region. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Another comment here, Boyd's got.
Yeah, Dan, also that has probably the biggest effect on that is the amount of private land, contiguous private land, and we have so much more public land in this region that most of the other regions don't have as much as we do. And so it's just more conducive. Like, for example, you look at the northern region where most of the CWMUs are, there's so much more private land.
We have units in the northern region that are 95% private lands. There's basically 5% public land in the unit. So that is more conducive to block up large blocks of land that would qualify for a CWMU. And they definitely have the lion's share of the CWMU's owners.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Are we aware of the landowners reasoning for requesting that state school section be added back into the CWMUs?
They didn't state specifically why. I think you just have to look at it at face value why. There's no additional permits to them, but it's and talking to the region, it's a very good piece of property to be hunting. There's a lot of wildlife on it, basically.
So. But there is a less permits will actually be, the permits are going to go out on it if it was in the CWMU, are really not that many.
This was explained last night too. The difference between it would be is that there's three additional public permits, two deer and one elk permit. The landowner indicated that he has been letting at least two to three per hunt, on archery hunt, muzzleloader hunts, elk hunts, and everything. He lets two to three public who contact him, it doesn't matter who it does, that he lets them through to be able to hunt their property in addition to the public property. So their net gain in public access, if it's not included, is how it was put.
So he could be just a really nice guy and just want to tell people, no, I don't want to drive across my land.
It could be, yeah.
So, there are those guys.
There's guys that do that.
Any other questions from Iraq? Any questions from the public? Discussion from the RAC? Discussion. Comments from the public. Comments from the public. Well, we'll call for a motion.
I make a motion to approve the CWMU plan and numbers as recommended by the division.
All right, second it.
Okay. Motion and a second. Any discussion on it? On the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passed unanimously. Okay. 7, landowner permit numbers, 2014.
Okay. Nobody loves you like I love you.
Thank you. So good. Next, I'll present the statewide 2014 Landowner Association applications. And, we received 15 applications this year. There was a slight change from when this came out in the original RAC packet, and I'll explain those changes. It's been more application. There was an oversight on the Henry Mountains. They qualify for one permit every 3 years as an association. There was an oversight on our part, but anyways, we got the application in and it has been included. So we received 15 applications. The Division of Wildlife recommends approval of 12 of the applications as received, and there's three split recommendations instead of four, as was originally done. So in 2013, the vouchers total would be, out of the 15 landowner associations, there would be 115 deer vouchers, of which one of those will be a management buck voucher, 76 elk vouchers, and 8 pronghorn vouchers. Okay, we had some split recommendations. The Vernon Landowner Association is a buck deer landowner association, mostly in Tooele County, I believe. And they requested 35. They request this every year. Because of the reduction in unit permits, they qualify for 28, and the division recommends 28. What happens with this is that in order to qualify for a landowner association, they have to enroll at a minimum of 51% of the private lands within the limited entry unit for a buck deer, bull elk, or a pronghorn. And they take the percentage of private lands that is enrolled in that, and which makes them qualify for a percentage of the limited entry unit permits that are offered for that unit. And when those decrease, we recommend a corresponding decrease with the numbers in the, on the landowner association also. So that's why the reduction in unit permits dictates that we recommend the lower number of permits for the landowner association. The Ponsagant Landowner Wildlife Association, it's management buck deer permits. They requested four, they qualify for one. There's been a significant reduction. They've reached their management goals with the management buck hunts there, and they qualify for one management buck as opposed to the four. I think that last year they qualified for four, but there's a significant reduction in that. Panguitch Lake is no longer a split recommendation. That was agreed upon. They qualify for seven, and we recommend seven on that. Indian Peaks Landowner Association is a request every year from them. They would like to have three premium permits. Premium permits allow them to hunt all the seasons, which is not allowed by rule. So we go with the recommendation they qualify for three regular permits instead of the premium status on that. And the Diamond Mountain Landowner Association has also requested a variance to their with their application, and I believe they will address that tonight. Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah, we've got a comment card. Yep.
Okay. So we were going to do a proposed change to the landowner permit rule this evening, but because it wasn't clearly stated in the agenda, we've decided we will do this in the next RAC round. But basically, this is an amendment that a lot of people have been asking for. So we'll do that in the next round of RAC meetings and the next board meeting in January. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Okay, questions from the RAC? Questions from the public? Discussion by the RAC?
I guess I got a question. If we're going to discuss the Diamond Mountain Landowner Association next time, if we support your recommendation today, are we going to have to overdo that in January?
I guess I can speak to this. It's not an agenda or an action item, but the recommendation to change the rule, what it will do is it will change it to, instead of having to annually apply for a diamond, for example, the Diamond Mountain Landowner Association or any of the landowner associations, it'll be done similar to what's being done with the CWMU program, where you submit an application, and it's good for 3 years unless there's some changes. There's a process that you can go through to apply for changes. For example, if the land ownership changes, you can submit a change application if you want. It allows the division, if there's a decrease in limited entry permit numbers, we can ask for it correspondingly. Corresponding decrease in the landowner association permits, and any changes to the association bylaws or anything like that. So what it'll do is it'll make it easier for the association. Some of them have to get in excess of 100 signatures a year. And it'll just make that so they only have to do that once every 3 years, and the variances that are applied for that time will be for a three-year time also.
But us tonight adopting the Landowner Association voucher numbers won't affect what we do in January.
No, it won't. Still, what they will have to do, because the rule will take effect if it's approved, it will take effect prior to the next application period. So when the Landowner Association applies by September 1st, they'll still have to go through the same process this one more time, but it won't have to be done again for another 3 years after that. So, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I think maybe we got to jump to... We've had a good discussion here. Anyway, Michael McCarl has a variance letter. Wanted to read.
My name is Michael McCarl, and I'm a little bit confused. I was told that we wouldn't do this till the 18th of December. None of our guys are here, because I told them it wouldn't be tonight. Am I in arrears on that?
The permits were still going to be done. That was on the agenda, but the additional rule, but the rule change for the three-year thing is carried over till December.
So do I read the variance letter tonight? I was under the impression I wasn't supposed to do that. I certainly will try to hear. Do the members of the board have a copy of it?
I think the board needs to hear it at this point in discussion and stuff. It's being used. I just need to hear it.
Does anybody have a copy of the letter?
I don't think I received it.
The letter was, I looked through the packet. The letter didn't come through the packet. If you need to have a copy of it, I will be more than happy to run and make a copy.
Here, boys.
I'll sit down.
Okay. Any other discussion? Anything we can, questions?
I believe that the letter that he's printing off was submitted with the application.
Yes, it was.
And was recommended for approval with the application.
Yes, it was. Okay. I apologize. I haven't done that before, but I should probably include a copy of the letter for the RACs in the RAC packet.
Mr. McFarland,
yes.
Regarding the application, will that still go through the RAC every 3 years?
Yes,
it'll have variance.
Yes, and if there's any changes to the application, like if there's changes to permit numbers or the acreage, if somebody drops out or there's additions or something, they still have to file an amendment to that. That'll have to be approved by the RAC and the board. But that's only if there's a change. If there's no change, they'll only have to apply once every 3 years.
Okay. What are the stipulations or what are the requests on that application? What does the application require?
The application requires a signature from the member. Like I said before, they have to enroll a minimum of 51% of the private lands within the limited entry unit. So that the acreage has to be recorded, they have to have the landowner's signatures for that, they have to have a copy of their bylaws and have the permit allocations will be divided out amongst the members of the association.
Can you be your packet under, I think it's section 6, it tells you what's required.
I just wondered what was included on the actual application, but it's most necessary.
I guess just a point there, you clarified that it was a recommendation that they do approve the variance as it comes in. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's been recommended that we approve the variance also. That was sent to us and recommended the variance be approved, yes.
Can you read off the variance for me?
I don't have a copy of it.
How about a codebook?
Is there qualifications for the variance?
No, the variance itself.
I don't have a copy of it in front of me.
I just think that it might be advantageous to understand what we are approving.
I can do that. I just need to have, I don't have a copy right with me.
There's a copy. Is this the letter?
Landowner letter.
That's the landowner. You want me to read the what the variance entails, right?
Correct.
In code?
If possible.
Okay, I can read that.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, please. Okay. Let's see. Landowner Association certificate registration, including any variance granted over the 3 years. Okay. The Landowner Association may petition to amend the certificate of registration upon submitting a written application where the Landowner Association is located. No, I'm sorry. That. I jumped ahead. Give me a second. I'm going to be right back with a copy of the rule.
Sorry, thank you.
That's okay. Not a problem.
While we're waiting, I guess what the rule says is that a landowner association can apply for a variance to the part of the rule that says that for every voucher that is redeemed by the landowner association, they need to allow one other person, a public person from the limited entry unit, access to the limited entry association lands. Is basically what it says. But there is a part in the rule that the landowner association can request an amendment to that, or a variance to that, that allows them to not allow those permits to be allowed on association lands.
So the variance essentially states that they are not required to allow the public to enter their land.
The private lands.
Correct. And from years past, and if you've got the code, we'll read that before I go into my annual spiel.
Okay, this is by rule, okay, not code, rule. This is R657-53-8, section 6A. The landowners who transfer to other hunters may deny public access to the Landowners Association's property, land for hunting, by requesting through the Landowner Association a variance to subsection 5B, just above there. The requested variance must be approved by the Landowner Association in writing to the division 30 days prior, so it's submitted with the application. It's submitted by the Landowner Association, which they are doing. And then and that's it. So it's just that they are asking for a variance so that they do not have to transfer vouchers to other hunters and may deny public access to private lands.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready for my spiel?
And then they submitted this letter here, which has been seen and recommended approved.
Here's my annual spiel, and this is going to be brief this year, gentlemen. I understand that this works currently. I understand that this has worked for 18 years and that this has been advantageous for not only the Landowner Association but the public. But my request as a representative at large of my constituents is that we are verifying that they are allowing the public, and I have asked that annually every year, that we can get verification of the public that is allowed on the property, because I understand they're allowing them, but we don't have any documentation or any proof. It's been said that there is a list and that they are being allowed, and I have zero doubt whatsoever. But in order to justify this variance, I need to see that the public resource is being utilized as a public resource and not a private entity. So it would be my request that, along with the application, if this is going to be a three-year assignment, that we request that is submitted annually, the public that was allowed on the property.
Variance.
But they're stating
they're not. If you read their letter, it's not in their letter.
They're not
stating that they're letting public on.
Right.
and it's not part of the variant, request of the variance.
So they have to let zero public onto the private land?
That's what the variance request. Yes.
Then what's the point? The entire ordeal, what's the point? We're giving vouchers for animals that are being sold, correct? At what benefit is this to the public?
I guess they're private land providing habitat for wildlife.
Gary, what those permits are doing is they're providing relief for depredation. They're allowing us to manage that in a more effective way than it was during the general season. Now, as far as the landowners, there is a lot of public ground up there, and there is no public ground that isn't accessible.
And that's
been argued. Right, well, there isn't. I mean, you can't get to all of it in a Jeep, but you get to it by horse or by foot. The public has benefited from this by the improvement in the hunting, the quality of the hunting up there. And we have had a list every year of individuals that we've let on our private ground. I'm not sure if we got one put together this year or not yet, Stoney. We've brought in a list every year, and our list has always been greater than what the CWMUs have had to allow in. And we can get that list together again this year. We've had to do that because we've had this hammer over our head on Diamond Mountain. So we do let public hunters on, but we reserve the right to be able to turn them down if we want to.
Which, as a private landowner, I 100% respect that. Six ways to Sunday, I understand the stress that puts on the private land in and of itself, especially if you're required to let all those people on, and they all conglomerate into one location. That could be detrimental to the herd in general. But I get a ton of feedback from the public who say that this has become a private hunting show. And that's my concern, is that there's limited public access to the private or to the public lands, because it's essentially an island of private land around public land, from what I understand. And so I just think it would help relieve the tension and relieve the stress if we can say Diamond Mountain is allowing public onto their land, and they're working with the public, and they've created this wonderful, beautiful hunting extravaganza, and we can show that. Does that make sense?
And that's what our list has done, hasn't Stoney?
But I've never seen it presented.
Haven't you? We had one last year.
Let's go on a little more discussion here.
Just a question. How many public permits are issued for Diamond Mountain area every year? Elk and deer.
I can tell you how many are on the Diamond Mountain, but
not the vouchers, or just the public permits in the draw process.
Could you, the region, tell me what the public share
for deer?
The times the private is getting by two, and that's how many public are being issued, pretty much. About a third of the permits.
So what is it, 88? Yeah, 88 or 90 deer?
So a third.
Yeah. 120
deer and 50 elk are issued to the public, in addition to the private vouchers that we're talking about now.
I think so. I'm not sure. I don't know if I stretching.
And the quality of that hunt has improved significantly the last 8 or 10 years.
The hunters that we get feedback from, they're satisfied. Around 4 for satisfaction, out of 5 to see
it. Okay.
The Landowner Association, part of the reason they put this rule together is to make wildlife valuable on the private properties also, and give them an incentive to manage for the wildlife, to provide some means of compensation for damage, whether it be rangeland or agricultural damage. In a lot of cases, it's allowed us to increase populations in these units, and that's the purpose of the Landowner Association, for the purpose of that rule. And if it's accomplishing that purpose, it would take a rule change to require them to provide a list of, I don't even know if this would go into a rule, to require them to provide a list of public that they weren't required to, as a result of the variance, they weren't required to let onto the property. And so, I understand what you're saying, but something's not required in the rule for them, if they get the variance, to provide that list.
Mr. Chairman. Justin, I got a question. Do you get, from the hunters, the public hunters that dry out, do you get a significant return of negative comments or feedback from those hunters?
If we did, it would come through the region. So.
Because I know it wasn't too many meetings ago, we was one of the most favorable landowner associations from the public hunters. But if there is a list, I think the association would like to know about it and what their qualms are.
I don't know, as the region, yeah, you probably appreciate it.
Amy Vantort. So the feedback we get comes from a random sampling from the hunters, and so we don't get, it's all anonymous through the licensing that we go through, but it's all been around 4 is the average for satisfaction. So we don't get any real comments from people that aren't happy unless they come talk to us directly.
So as far as public satisfaction, do you feel it's normal or above normal, or
yeah, it's okay? Yeah, it's good. It's typically above normal than a general season hunt. Usually it's around 3 or so, but it's around 4. So I'd say it's good.
The way that works is a 1 to 5 rating on it. 1 being very dissatisfied, 2 being dissatisfied, 3 being neutral, 4 being satisfied, and 5 being very satisfied. So that's basically how it works. And it sounds like it is working. If they have an average satisfaction of 4, the people are fairly satisfied. There's not very many of the units that get a 5 satisfaction rating.
So, and make sure I understand it. That was public draw permits, not just permit holders. Or was that just permit holders? Which, you know, if I had a landowner voucher, I went and got a permit. Would I be included in that survey?
It'd be anyone who draws out. So the public.
So it'd be a draw.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The landowner association gets their permits in the form of vouchers that they redeem for licenses, a tags and a license.
Just one observation. There's a question about was the public being enhanced or helped out. A lot of the public know the boundaries of the association, and the quality of hunt around those boundaries has definitely gone up.
If anyone's been to Alaska, to the confluence of the Russian and Kenai, that's what it's like on the road. Just waiting for them to step off the road. As well as several other places.
Another quick comment, Mr. Chairman. I know that Stoney and the Diamond Mountain landowners have went out of their way to make sure that the public's been satisfied, because they've had this hammer over their head every year when they come into this meeting.
So
it's
they,
something they're aware of.
Are they no longer going to make sure the public is satisfied if we remove the hammer from over their head?
No, because the hammer doesn't just come from UK. The hammer comes from Salt Lake City.
Absolutely.
Just a comment. Around the rest of the state, I hunt some of the other part of the state. There's units you can't get to. They are closed. And here in the Uinta Basin, this happens to be the one spot that all the Uinta Basin people see as a closed unit. It's not a closed unit. You got a third of the tag still being sold to the public. So you can hunt those edges and those perimeters.
Two-thirds,
really. Okay, two-thirds, not a third. Okay, I misunderstood that.
Just to add to what you're saying, the landowner's incentive in all of this is to provide habitat so that the public does have access to that quality hunt.
Let's be just.
I am being very just, because without the compensation of the vouchers, the landowners aren't going to have those livestock or that elk herd smashing through their fences and drinking their pond water that they're hauling, and they're not going to do it. They're not going to allow it. The 30% of the vouchers or the tags that are drawn are pretty coveted, and people appreciate it. The landowners are the ones that are supplying that opportunity, because they're the ones that supply the habitat. Pretty much. The critical habitat, pretty much. So it's a valuable program. It's benefited the landowners. It's encouraged them to support wildlife programs, and it enhances the public's opportunity for a quality hunt, which meets all of our requirements, I believe.
And I agree with you. I just think it's a dangerous game that we play when we start selling public resource, regardless of where its habitat is.
Good discussion. Good discussion. Anything else?
Make sure I just understand, and I think I do, the Landowner Association program requires the Landowner Association to allow the public to hunt on their property, kind of a one-on-one type thing, is that right? And, but this the variance is allowing us, you know, allowing the Diamond Mountain to not follow that suit for good reasons.
Yeah, what the rule allows for is for every permit voucher that is redeemed for a license or a tag, they're supposed to allow somebody else that has drawn the public permit for that limited entry unit. And this is a variance deviating from that, basically.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. I don't understand the purpose of the variance. If the landowner association still allows people in, what they don't have to.
They don't have
to. I know. I understand it. I understand that's what the variance is asking for, but you do that anyway.
Right.
At your discretion. Am I understanding this correctly?
Right. Okay. And we've had a list, and we could get a list.
Sure.
When do I get it first? I don't know if I'm supposed to read that or not, but I don't have a copy anymore.
I scribbled on mine, so you're welcome to it.
How about his?
Yeah, probably.
He can't read anyway.
Sorry.
You might find out something about yourself on that paper.
Hey, this is nothing bad on it.
First of all, I appreciate the time of the Regional Wildlife Committee for hearing this. Dear Northeastern Region RAC, in compliance with R657-43-8, subparagraph 6, the Diamond Mountain Landowner Association is respectfully requesting an access variance. This request is consistent with the rule as set by the Wildlife Board and has been granted to the Diamond Mountain LOA since the paragraph was included. As a committee, we represent 156 landowners. That should actually say 156 landowners or groups of landowners, because there's somewhere over 250 actually partners in the land. But within the Diamond Mountain Limited Entry Hunting Unit, the landowners on this management unit own 82,114 acres. The LOA is requesting a variance to assist private property landowners to manage hunters that could potentially access private property owned hunting unit. Following the permit allocation process, the Diamond Mountain LOA qualifies and receives approximately 35% of the total permits as vouchers for bull, elk, and buck deer. If the Diamond Mountain LOA is required to allow one public hunter to access any of the private ground within our association for each private voucher, we could potentially have 70% of the hunters on any piece of private property. We as individual landowners are concerned for safety and the need to control access to our homes and private property. The Diamond Mountain LOA was one of the first LOAs in the state. Through this LOA, we've maintained a successful working relationship with the DWR for more than 18 years. The Diamond Mountain LOA appreciates the opportunity to manage our lands for wildlife and thus increase wildlife populations. We have worked cooperatively with the support of governmental agencies, wildlife groups, and individual resource users. We appreciate the support from the Wildlife Board, RAC, and DWR helping us to improve hunting and wildlife viewing opportunities. Through these relationships, we have experienced great success enhancing the resources on this unit. We appreciate the continued opportunity to make this variance request and your consideration. Sincerely, Michael McCarver. My one comment from me, I can only speak specifically to my ground. Me and one of my neighbors are combined. We did not get an elk tag this year. We own together a little over 3,000 acres. We've been cut every year, which we approved as a landowner association, the permit numbers on the elk. I got one deer tag. On my ground specifically, I allowed 3 elk hunters, 2 deer hunters, 2 bear hunters, and there's 2 people hunting cows up there right now. if it's mandated that I have someone that just gets sent to me, I can't do that because I can't just throw it open to everyone at every time. I schedule those folks, I make sure that they know their responsibilities and make certain that they respond to those. With 156 landowners and us only getting 34 elk tags this year to open up all 156 parcels of ground, can't work. It absolutely cannot work. If we wouldn't last 5 more minutes, none of us, it would be finished. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the board?
Yeah, I have another question. Just sort of a disconnect in my mind here. If the LOA receives 35% of the tax, is that correct? Then how is it that they can have 70% of the hunters on a single piece of private property?
That's in your letter, I don't know.
The
way the rule is written, as I understand, and I've read it several times, if you have one permit, you need to allow one public hunter on the entire private ground. Is that correct, Lord? Yes.
That's
so, whether you get a permit or not, if you're a member of the Landowner Association, you have to access however many permits that you have. You have to access, or you have to allow access from that specific number of public hunters into the entire 82,000 acres. Which, I don't know how many homes there are. I'm a year-round resident up there. I live there. I can't let 35 people on my ground. I can't do that. It won't work. So.
Questions, discussion? Okay, we have a proposal before us that's been presented by Scott. Any motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the Landowner Association recommendation as a Wildlife Division with the Diamond Mountain Association's variance.
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? That's kind of what was presented. This DWR was going to approve the variance, so. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
One opposed?
Carried. Two.
Two? Two opposed. Carrie and Dave?
Dan.
Okay, Dan, sorry. I'm on the table, I didn't know who raised your hand. Okay. Motion passes majority. Let's go move to our next item on the agenda. To a hunter mentoring program.
Good evening, Mr. Chairperson, members of the RAC. My name is Greg Hansen, and I'm here to present a new administrative rule and licensing program proposed by the division, the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program. Last year, the Utah legislature amended Wildlife Code 2319 and 1 to allow certain situations when a minor can use a hunting permit held by another individual. The purpose of this program was to increase youth recruitment into hunting and remove some barriers that we were seeing as impairing youth from getting into the sport, to provide a network that and structure that would provide education to these youth on hunting ethics and safety, and to encourage hunting as a family experience in Utah. So the division took the changes to the Wildlife Code and drafted a new administrative rule and kind of set up an administrative process for putting this program together. Both the minor children and the mentoring adults have to meet certain qualifications that are laid out in code and specified in this new rule. There's a process that the participants have to go through so that we can ensure that they qualify and are consistent with the changes in code, and also to allow the division to track permit usage both for law enforcement purposes and to be able to tell whether we're actually seeing benefits, whether we're actually seeing an increase in youth participation. And then also there are certain parameters that the youth and the mentor have to follow when they're out in the field to ensure the mentoring's occurring, to ensure the proper safety is being followed, those kind of elements. So question, can my child participate in this program? Right now the program's open to Utah residents only on the minor side, and that's actually provided for in code. The child must be between the ages of 12 and 17 when hunting, and they must possess a Utah Hunter's education number, so they must have gone through Hunter's Ed prior to participating. There are two different classifications of children that qualify. The first is if the minor is the child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward of the hunting mentor, or if the child is suffering from a life-threatening medical condition. So that second category of child wouldn't have to be biologically related to the mentor that shares the permit and takes them out in the field. In order to be a hunting mentor, you can be either a resident or a non-resident, and that's also provided for in code. You must possess a valid big game permit that's shared with the child, and you must be 21 years or older when hunting. We provided that the mentor is responsible for ensuring that the minor mentor pair complies with all elements of the wildlife code, administrative rules, and provisions set forth in the big game proclamation. And we've provided that the mentor may not receive any type of compensation for sharing their permit and taking the child out into the field. So we believe this will ensure that the program's limited to those two classifications of children, that it's not a neighbor taking the neighbor's child out, and also that this kind of follows the purpose of the program. It's supposed to be a family experience, not a money-making endeavor for someone who draws a big game permit. If you believe that you qualify, we've asked that you submit an application at least 10 days before the date of sharing the permit. A handling fee will be assessed, and that's set up in the legislative fee schedule right now. That's $10. And the mentor will have to provide all evidence of that both the minor and the mentor qualify for the program. So they'll have to submit the big game permit number that they're wanting to share. Right now we've opened that up to all big game permits, including once-in-a-lifetime species, limited entry hunts, antlerless, CWMU. They have to submit a description of the minor, the minor's hunter education number, and a certification that both the minor and the mentor qualify for the program, so that the minor is actually the child, grandchild, stepchild, or legal ward of the mentor, or that they have a life-threatening medical condition. And for example, the mentor is at least 21 years old when they're out in the field. Second, if the child that's accompanying the mentor, if the mentor is not the legal guardian of the child, we've requested that the mentor also submit written authorization from the minor's parents that the parents are okay with their child participating in the program, so that it's not... there are no family quarrels, I guess, resulting from participating in the program. Finally, we've limited the program right now to only one minor mentor pair per permit at one time. So there will only be one child with the mentor out in the field. However, we've set up a process where if the mentor wanted to share their permit with a second time with a different child, they can surrender the authorization, resubmit a new application with a different child, have that same administrative process go forward, and take a child out on a different weekend, for example. However, we do have that 10-day administrative buffer period, so that in and of itself will limit certain permits that would be able to have that second child participate. If you do qualify and go out in the field, the mentor must be close enough to the minor to communicate with voice and hand signals, and must also provide advice and assistance with proper hunting techniques, safety, and ethics. That's actually written into the code section that set up the program. So That's why that's also in the rule. The mentor is also responsible for possessing the permit, the license, all the certifications that went into ensuring that the minor and mentor both qualified for the program, and the division approval that they can chair the permit. You'll notice the asterisks on the license word. The division has proposed to waive the license requirement for the child as an incentive to get them out to the field. Once again, removing another barrier that could have prevented the child from participating. Both the minor and the mentor may carry a firearm, but only one animal may be taken and tagged per permit. So we've stuck closely to that one permit, one animal requirement. Effects of sharing the permit. All of the rules for variances, surrenders, refunds, and disability accommodations will be based on the type of the permit that's shared and the individuals that are using the permit. And all bonus points, preference points, and waiting periods will be assessed to the mentor, not the minor that shares the permit if they do end up taking the animal. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Greg. Questions by the rack?
Yeah, I have a question, and I appreciate your looking towards the family, particularly in the mentoring. And my question is there some reason that you left out an uncle or an aunt that might take a nephew or a niece out on there?
That question has come up in I think just about every region. The classifications that are provided in rule are also provided in code, and so we couldn't expand that program to stepchildren or nephews, nieces, those type of children, because we don't have the authority from the wildlife code to do so. Based on how successful this program is in other states and general sentiment by the division, that might be something that we approach the legislature in the future about, but right now, that is all that we can do.
Other questions from the RAG?
Is this just a big game program then?
Yeah. Right now we have limited it to only big game hunting permits, but all categories of big game hunting permits. Maybe one more item that I should throw out there that's come up in a lot of RACs is that there are other limitations in the Wildlife Code and our administrative rules that limit the possession of a big game permit to only one big game antlered permit per species per year, and the taking of only one antlered big game permit per species per year. And that will remain consistent with this program. So if a child draws an antlered big game permit, they would not qualify to participate in this program and share with another big game permit that their mentor had drawn. That might not have been clear enough in the rule, and it's come up enough times in other acts that may be, we might propose to clarify that in rule prior to taking it to the board.
Can the child only be identified by one mentor? So let's say I want to take my little boy and I have a lifetime license and his dad draws a tag. Can he take him in addition to me, or does lifetime license win and I get to take him?
He would only
be one.
Right.
As written, and the proposal of the division is that child can only share one permit at a time. That goes to those other restrictions that are in the Wildlife Code that limit it to one antlered animal per season per individual.
What if I draw archery and his dad draws rifle?
And antlerless, the child could do both. Antlered, no.
Okay.
Per species. Yep.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So who's the best shot? The kid or the dad?
Okay. Any other questions?
The kid.
Okay. That's what you want.
Any questions from the public? No comment cards. New discussion by the RAC.
Go team.
Go team.
This is a win. This was a win when it was presented a little over a year ago. This was a win when it was born. And I can't tell you how ecstatic I am to even see this.
Okay.
I might get our 657-675 tattooed somewhere. This is fantastic.
Now get this, me and her is going to agree.
Oh my gosh, that never happens.
You're going to get the tattoo too?
You need the tattoo too.
And I'm going to put it in a diamond, just saying.
Okay, call for a motion.
I move to accept.
So I second it. I seconded.
Mitch seconded.
Goose.
I didn't do you tonight.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. We'll move on to our dedicated hunter rule amendment, Brian Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Council members. I'm Brian Christensen, and I'm the Dedicated Hunter Program and Volunteer Services Coordinator from the Salt Lake office. This rule has had a revision back in 2011 when we were transitioning from regional hunting into unit-based hunting. And so what we're primarily doing today is kind of cleaning up, reorganizing, updating the rule. But we're also, let me just go to this next one here. We're going to reorganize it, simplify it dramatically. And when we were doing all this work with the rule, we also had the opportunity to comb through it and address a wildlife board action log item regarding service hours. So as far as simplification goes, we're essentially going to we took out all the wording that was very, very unique and specific to 2012. And that would have been the stuff that directed the current applicants or the current dedicated hunters and how they were going to transition into unit hunting from regional hunting. That no longer applies, so we can take that out. We removed the dates from when the division was required to print, or rather required not to print permits and mail them. We just took that out, so we have a little bit more ability to manage that ourselves. The next one is to allow dedicated hunters that have incomplete hours. This might take a little explanation. There are occasionally dedicated hunters that go through the program all 3 years and their COR expires and they haven't completed all their hours. What that does mean is that they didn't get all the permits either. But they're still obligated to complete all their hours regardless of how many permits they redeemed through the program. The current rule says they have to pay off those hours in a monetary amount at $20 an hour. What this revision or this recommendation would do is allow dedicated hunters to find themselves in that situation after their three years has expired. We would allow them to jump on a project instead or pay off their hours if that works better for them. But it lets them do service work to complete that obligation. Last one here is the time frame in which a permit can be returned. Every dedicated hunter has to return a permit in order to show that they did not harvest. And that time frame has changed over the years. It's been a deadline of January for some years, and then last year it was March 15th. We can actually manage that return process without having a hard date and rule. It's just not necessarily as important as it used to be in prior years. The clarifications, the certificates of registration currently expire the last day of the year. What we're changing on this one is to have the certificate of registration expire on the last day of the general season. In some cases, that might be the last day of the year, but where there's extended archery, that day could be December 15th, or it doesn't have to be December 31st. It's just whatever the last date in which they can hunt in general season. The definition of youth, this is the same definition that Justin presented earlier. We're just adopting the same one so that we're consistent throughout the rules. Dedicated hunter preference points. We didn't have anything very, very specific that said when we could reinstate a dedicated hunter's preference points upon surrender of a certificate of registration. There is occasionally someone that will draw and not even start hours, not even redeem a permit, and it may be for injury or whatever reason. We needed something that said when we could reinstate those points. It's very similar to what we do with general season permits. Poaching reported reward permit. That tongue twister. We didn't have anything as well that classified a poaching reported reward permit in a way that directed us what to do if somebody were to both be a dedicated hunter and have the opportunity to accept one of these deer permits as well. So we've added just a couple of words that helps us there. And then this last item on this screen is actually a definition that will be inserted into R657-62, which is the application procedure rule. That rule describes the requirement for applicants to take a program orientation course before they're allowed to apply for the program. So this definition will actually go into that rule rather than stay in the dedicated hunter rule. Now for the action log item, we were asked, and I'm going to read this word for word here, for DWR to reconsider allowing dedicated hunter program applicants to accrue volunteer hours in the first year after they apply in the program rather than waiting until the final selections and approval. Essentially, the current rule, what it does is applicants will apply. They'll find out if they draw in May, just with all the other big game stuff, and they'll have about 10 weeks, roughly, to do their first 8 hours of service. The current program has a requirement that they do 8 hours the first year, 16 additional the next year, and then 8 the final year. A few of the dedicated hunters have expressed that they like an option of doing hours prior to joining. And in 2013, let me give you an idea of how that 10-week period goes. We had roughly 19,000 service hours we needed to provide during those 10 weeks. And so it would make some sense to explore a program as the Wildlife Board requested to maybe get those hours done early or some other method. So we did explore it. Fortunately, the division has some excellent staff. We have some phenomenal partners with conservation groups, with federal agencies, and some other groups, and we're able to provide those 19,000 hours of opportunity in that short time frame, but it is a crunch. So we gladly explored what has been called a banking concept, and what it does is essentially it would allow people to do hours and have them stored some location and be able to apply those hours into a future COR. We did explore two very, very specific versions. And at the end of it, as we kind of walked through each scenario, we found that banking hours as a concept doesn't necessarily mean that all of the dedicated hunters are going to take advantage of that. It also doesn't mean in every scenario that it's beneficial to both the division and the dedicated hunter. In some scenarios, it's great for one and not the other. So what we're recommending in lieu, and we feel like this is going to satisfy that request that the Wildlife Board asked us to do, is actually just redistribute the hours. So we're recommending that in year one, the dedicated hunter doesn't have to do the first 8 hours. They can come in, do their conservation and ethics training course, and redeem a permit. The second year would be basically the same as it is now. They'd have 16 hours to do. And then the third year, another 16. What this essentially does is those 19,000 hours that would be in that 10-week period, it opens all of those up to about a year and a half worth of time, including spring projects, which we find are pretty valuable, especially in our southern portion of the state. Alleviates a lot of that pressure to get it done quick in that short time frame. And it also it removes a need for a fairly complicated tracking system that would need to be implemented to do a banking type concept. So we feel like this option satisfies both the Wildlife Board's purposes for that request and is a benefit to both the division and the Dead Cat Hunter. Thank you.
Questions from Iraq?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I might have misunderstood, just a clarification. Did you say that if you don't complete your hours by the end of the third year, you can buy those off?
That's a good question, and it's come up every time. If you don't complete your hours right now, at the end of the third year, you have to pay for them.
And what's the cost of that?
$20 an hour. So there are some that have 8 hours to do. There are some that have 32 hours to do. And the penalty is that you can't ever apply for anything again until that's taken care of.
So I apply. I get accepted to the program. I go through the training.
Yep.
I don't have to do any hours the first year. I postpone my second and third year. I write you a check for $640. I have 3 years of tags. Then I can reapply again the next year without ever doing any service.
Okay, let me walk through that one more time with you. If you apply under the recommendation here, do the first training, redeem your permit, go hunting. You can't get your second permit until you've done 16 hours. We won't even print it for you. You won't be able to get your third permit until you've done 32 total hours. We won't even print it.
So how do you ever end up at the end of the year with the balance that you have to buy off?
You didn't get permits.
Okay.
You joined the program, went some duration, either you got one permit or two or zero, and you went 3 years, didn't do the service hours, you owe a balance. So those people that owe a balance didn't get a permit or more than one permit. They may not have gotten any. And what has happened, and what I can tell you is it's very, very few people that fall into that scenario. But they'll call us February 1st and say, the computer won't let me apply for anything anymore. And that's swan, turkey, cougar, bear, everything. They'll call us and say, what do I need to do? And our response has been, you owe us this amount of money. And very few of them can come up with that on the fly. Well, I can come up with a project pretty quick. That they can come in, do some service, and we can get them applying again. So they have the option to pay for them off or do some service under this recommendation. Does that help?
Yep, thanks.
Can you opt just to pay them off?
From the get-go?
Yes.
Residents can pay up to 24 of their 32 hours.
So
non-residents can purchase all of them.
Really?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of non-residents in the program. There are some, but many of them live on the East Coast or on the extreme West Coast. And for them to come into Utah and do 8 hours of service is often not feasible. So did
the non-residents, can they pay theirs off, did you say?
Yes, they're allowed to pay off.
Without doing any service?
Where that money goes, and this may answer a question that's out there. The money that's paid into those hours goes into a general fund for division purposes. If we have a need somewhere, we can take those funds and allocate them right to that need. And that might be project work, it might be equipment, it might be anything the division needs. That's where that money can be allocated. So it's still a benefit to the division.
Any other questions from Iraq?
Mr. Chairman?
Interesting.
Looking at your fences, where do you come up with your projects from? Do you take input from from people that see something that might be a good project?
Nothing allowed on Diamond, no.
Nothing.
No.
You got a haystack fence.
I was going to say, my gosh. Well,
that's a pretty looking fence.
Are you saying you like that picture on the right there?
Is the one on the left a dedicated hunter?
No.
That's one of my fences on Diamond.
That was Goose's fence right there.
This is a show-off slide. This is a before and after project. This is the same fence line. It's not the same
angle,
view, of course.
Obviously.
I wish it were.
That really doesn't look like a DWR fence to me.
So to answer your question, because it's a good one, is we take a variety of project sources. Some of them come directly from our habitat folks with the division. Some of them come from our facilities. A lot of them are done on wildlife management areas, and that may be fencing, it may be seeding. Some of them come from the U.S. Forest Service. They do a lot of work with us. BLM does. A lot of the federal agencies will work, and they kind of plan on each year having a burst of volunteers. The other avenues we also partner up with, the big sportsmen's groups and the little sportsmen's groups, they typically will come up with projects like guzzlers, reseedings, the transplants that were done, those kinds of things. We'll partner with them and allow dedicated hunters to help them, because it's, you know, it's a joint benefit. Sometimes dedicated hunters will come up with their own project proposals, and they'll submit them to us, and they'll say, we know an area that could use this, this, and this. And sometimes those are acceptable. Sometimes they're not directly enough related to wildlife that we deny a few of those. So all sources. It's written in the rule that a dedicated hunter can come up with their own, but it is subject to division approval.
Any other questions from Rack? Questions from the public?
Joey Draper again. I'm not a dedicated hunter, but I have looked into it. Do you guys have a preference on, like, say I want to get my 32-hour done in 1 year? You guys take it, you accept that?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
Okay.
Even though we wouldn't require the hours in that first year, a lot of dedicated hunters do like to get them done that first year, so they don't have to worry about it.
Absolutely.
And okay. And oddly enough, we have dedicated hunters that do 60, 70. There's some that even have in excess of 200 hours.
Okay.
Thank you. Good question.
That's everything.
Good. Any other discussion from the rack?
I move to accept as presented by the division.
Yeah. Motion,
yeah.
Second.
Yeah, there's no limit in extra tax.
I'll second that.
Dan will second. Dan seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passed unanimously. Any other items of business or anything we need to discuss? Entertain a motion.